This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation, available at podcast.lannan.org. Yvonne Boland with Nicholas Jenkins, recorded in Santa Fe on January 21st, 2004. Yvonne Boland has said, "I don't write a poem to express an experience. I write it to experience the experience." Boland is a renowned Irish poet and director of the Creative Writing Program at Stanford. In this program, she reads from a wide range of her work before sharing a conversation with fellow poet Nicholas Jenkins.
Good evening. My name is Nicholas Jenkins. The Lannan Foundation has long nurtured and engaged in a constructive connection to contemporary Irish writing. And so it's a particular pleasure for me to welcome you to the latest in the Lannan Foundation's Readings and Conversations series, which tonight will feature the internationally renowned Irish poet Yvonne Boland. Yvonne Boland was born in Dublin, but later spent much of her early childhood abroad, first in London, where her father was the first Irish ambassador to the Court of St. James, and later in New York, where he was the Irish ambassador to the United Nations. She returned to Dublin during her teenage years, and she attended and then lectured at Trinity College, Dublin. Her first book was New Territory, published in 1967, and since then, she's published, by my count, another 10 books of poetry, including In Her Own Image, 1980, The Journey, 1987, Outside History, 1990, In a Time of Violence, 1994, The Lost Land, 1998, and most recently, Against Love Poetry, 2001. She's also been a prolific and highly influential commentator on poetry, and most particularly on the ethics behind poetry, and she's the author of a book of beautiful essays, Object Lessons, which came out in 1995. And a further token of the discerning involvement of the Lannan Foundation in Irish writing, Yvonne Boland is the recipient of a Lannan Foundation Award. She's lectured, read, and taught widely in the United States and Europe, and is now Bella Mabry and Eloise Mabry Knapp Professor in Humanities at Stanford University, where she is the director of the Creative Writing Program. She's also a member of the board of the Irish Arts Council and a member of the Irish Academy of Letters. Well, such a stark and lengthy list of her achievements, and although it's lengthy, it's by no means complete. Such a stark list of Yvonne Boland's achievements and distinctions, extraordinary as it is, doesn't, I think, adequately convey the centrality of her work to contemporary poetic culture, not just in Ireland, but in Britain and in the United States too. The literary world truly is, in many senses, what Thomas Jefferson called a republic of letters, a democracy in which, at least in theory, all can take pen to paper and raise their voices. But in practice, of course, at any particular moment in history, some writers seem to rise above the crowd. Some writers seem to represent something much more than their own individual talents. They seem to embody in their work the burdens, hopes, angers, liberations, and longings of a much wider constituency, a constituency that is, in its turn, emblematic of a whole cultural and historical moment. Yvonne Boland, as an Irish poet, and as a poet who is a woman, is just such a writer. There are broad historical and personal dimensions to the Lannan's engagement with Irish writing, but another factor involved here must surely be that to a much greater extent than in most countries in the transatlantic world, both the United States and Ireland are works in progress, countries still coming into being. In his autobiographies, W.B. Yeats testifies vividly to his sense of excitement at feeling that a true, modern, sophisticated Irish culture was suddenly coming into being. And he uses a phrase with a kind of tender violence behind it to describe that feeling. "I began to plot and scheme how one might seal with the right image the soft wax before it began to harden," Yeats writes. Of course, as Yeats implies, These moments of creation and definition are brief. The wax cools and hardens, an image congeals, a form is given, and unease sets in. It's a moment of triumph, but also a moment when possibilities are closed off. The firmness of pressing a form into wax becomes the authoritarian stamp of tradition and ultimately of constraint. Yvonne Boland writes that for her, as a woman writing her first poems in Dublin in the 1960s, she found herself in a country and in a poetic culture where, and this is a quotation, the word woman and the word poet were almost magnetically opposed. Much of her subsequent work has been, often against considerable resistance, an effort to heal the rift between those two nouns so unjustly split apart. But in thinking about the ways in which Yvonne Boland has worked through in her poetry some of the most painful and complex issues in contemporary culture and society, I think that we need to balance our sense of how her critique, her political engagement, implicit as it is in her poems, is also counterpointed by our awareness of the local image by image, line by line, stanza by stanza, and poem by poem beauties of her work. For Boland is a poet of acute and patient fidelity to the raggedness and beauty of the actual shared world which we all, day after day, inhabit together. For example, in The Pomegranate, a poem which seems to me to have a special significance within the arc of her work, Boland writes about the ancient myth of a sundered mother and daughter, Persephone and Ceres. But that mythic structure is able to absorb intense and diverse sensory particularities at the same time. And it's that tension between worlds that I think generates the sense of energy that a reader feels in Boland's work. In this case, the diverse worlds include London, the city of fogs and strange consonants, the world of nature in a Dublin suburb, white beams and wasps and honey-scented buddleias, and the inner private space of a young woman asleep beside her teen magazines. Even at the heart of legend, as Boland writes it, is a lived, particularized reality. At the heart of legend, in the midst of rocks full of unshed tears, ready to be diamonds by the time the story was told, a child could be hungry. Or, as she puts it in her latest book, Against Love Poetry, her poetry forswears the emollient paraphernalia and terminology of romantic love and determines to write instead the contradictions of a daily love. And in doing this, Yvonne Boland has redefined for poets, for all poets, the contours of the political poem in our time. She's shown that the political poem is not the public poem, but it's the poem at which the that comes from the point at which the private world and the political coincide. Beauty is truth, truth, beauty, Keats wrote. And he thought the message was embodied on his Grecian urn as he gazed at it. Boland aligns herself, though, not with a poet of urns and a beauty that is truth, but with the painter Jean-Baptiste Chardin, painter and celebrant of bread, jugs, hairs, women dreaming at their diurnal tasks. Chardin, she writes, had done something different from Keats. He had taken truth and revealed beauty. And the same is true of Yvonne Boland. Please join me in welcoming her now.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Nick. First, want to begin by thanking Nick Jenkins for that wonderful introduction. I value Nick so much as obviously a colleague at Stanford, but also as a really wonderful scholar and advocate of poetry, and so I'm honored by the introduction. Also want to say I'm honored to be at the Lannan Foundation, and I want to thank everyone for bringing me here. It's one of the finest poetic series and conversations that there are, and it allows people to participate in the conversation about poetry, which is so valuable at sort of all moments in our lives. I'm just going to read some poems, some prose, and speak about how I came here. And I'm just going to begin with a very brief piece of prose which introduces some of the things which have influenced me most as a poet. It's just a straight piece of prose. In the early days of October in the year 1909, a woman entered a Dublin hospital near the center of the city of Dublin. The building is still there. If you approach from the south with the Dublin hills behind you, and you look down a tunnel of grace made by the houses of Fitzwilliam and Marion Squares, your view will end abruptly in this. The National Maternity Hospital, red brick and out of character, blocking the vista. The rooms inside are functional and light eating, and they show no evidence of that zest for air and proportion which was once the mask of the British oppressor. October is a beautiful month in the city of Dublin, and if you turn round and go back towards the hills, away from the hospital, the roads are narrow and gracious above the canal. The woman who entered the hospital might have passed them as she made her way to it, if, for instance, she drove round Stephen's Green. Having arrived on the late morning train from Drogheda, she might also have noticed a trick of light peculiar to that time of year. In the dark corridor of Lower Leeson Street, sunlight cuts the houses in half, and halfway up the brick, the reflection of the houses opposite builds another street, chimneys and roofs and gutters made of unglittering shadow. But she mightn't have come that way. She could have travelled down the unglamorous back streets that lead more directly to the hospital. Finian Street and Hogan Place past the mills, past the Dodder River on its way to the Liffey. It isn't a long drive, but whatever she saw that morning, it is lost. Whatever that journey yielded, the child with a hoop who never existed, the woman with a red hat I am now inventing, they were her last glimpses of the outside world. And this is the way we make the past, and this is the way I will make it here. Listening for hooves, glimpsing the red hat, which was never there in the first place, giving eyesight and evidence to a woman I never knew and cannot now recover. And for all our violations, the past waits for us. The road from the train to the hospital opens out over and over again, vacant and glittering, offering shadows and hats and hoops. And again, I visit it and reinvent it. But the woman who actually traveled it had no such freedom. Hers was a real journey, and she never came back. On October the 10th, 1909, she died in the National Maternity Hospital. She was 31 years of age, and she was my grandmother. The reason I chose that very brief piece is because of all the things that influenced me as a poet and goes on influencing me. It was the discovery when I was young, but I just couldn't have put it into words, of the huge difference between the past and history. And coming from Ireland, where history is so compelling and shaped in such powerful ways, there was a great temptation just to go to the history, just to go to the written version, which in Ireland is also a study of heroes. But the past is not a study of heroes. The past is this place of whispers and shadows. More and more, I began to feel, especially, that not only did many people live there, but many women lived there, that it was their past, that it wasn't heroic, and I wanted to go there in some way. This is a poem that I wrote at that time when I was beginning to understand that a little bit better. And it's called That the Science of Cartography is Limited. And it comes from the fact that in 1847, in the terrible potato famine, which came to Ireland, the relief committees came from England with their very cruel economics and told the people that in order to get food, they would have to work for the food. And, of course, the people had no strength to do that. And they gave them roads to build, especially in the west and the Midlands of the country. And if you're in the west of Ireland, especially Mayo, where my husband's people came from, and you look down in the woods, you can see these small roads which begin and just give out into nothing. And that's where the people died who built them. Those roads are the scar tissue of Irish history, and they never show up on any map. That the science of cartography is limited, and not simply by the fact that this shading of forest cannot show the fragrance of balsam, the gloom of cypresses, is what I wish to prove. When you and I were first in love, we drove to the borders of Connacht and entered a wood there. Look down, you said, this was once a famine road. I looked down at ivy and the scotch grass rough cast stone had disappeared into, as you told me in the second winter of their ordeal, in 1847, when the crop had failed twice. Relief committees gave the starving Irish such roads to build. Where they died, there the road ended and ends still. And when I take down the map of this island, it is never so I can say, here is the masterful, the apt rendering of the spherical as flat, nor an ingenious design which persuades a curve into a plane, but to tell myself again that the line which says woodland and cries hunger and gives out among sweet pine and cypress and finds no horizon will not be there. That whole sense of the lost history began to be more and more present to me and more important to me. And this is a poem that in some sense frames this reading. It's a poem about 23 years ago. Kevin, my husband, and I went to Iowa and took these very small children with us. And they were two little girls. And one of them, who was 11 months old, became deathly ill. And we truly thought she would die, and she made a wonderful recovery. But she was 11 months old, she had meningitis, and it was a terrible moment for us. I went back some years later to read for the workshop, and I saw the bridge in Iowa City where Kevin and I had met on a snowy day when everything seemed to be in doubt. And this is also a poem of love and memory, and it's also that poem about the past and its shadows, because, you know, I in many ways built this poem in the great part of the Aeneid, the sixth book, where Aeneas goes over the river into the underworld, and all these people he's known come up to him, and they shout, but suddenly their voices are all whispers, because it's the underworld, it's the place of forgetting. So I could see Kevin clearly in front of me, but of course he was a memory. He couldn't see me. This poem is called Love. Dark falls on this Midwestern town where we once lived when myths collided. Dusk has hidden the bridge in the river which slides and deepens to become the water the hero crossed on his way to hell. Not far from here is our old apartment. We had a kitchen and an Amish table. We had a view. And we discovered there love had the feather and muscle of wings and had come to live with us, a brother of fire and air. We had two infant children, one of whom was touched by death in this town and spared. And when the hero was hailed by his comrades in hell, their mouths opened and their voices failed, and there is no knowing what they would have asked about a life they had shared and lost. I am your wife. It was years ago. Our child is healed. We love each other still. Across our day-to-day, and ordinary distances, we speak plainly. We hear each other clearly. And yet I want to return to you on the bridge of the Iowa River as you were, with snow on the shoulders of your coat and a car passing with its headlights on. And I see you as a hero in a text, the image blazing and the edges gilded, and I long to cry out the epic question, my dear companion. Will we ever live so intensely again? Will love come to us again and be so formidable at rest it offered us ascension even to look at him? But the words are shadows, and you cannot hear me. You walk away, and I cannot follow. When I was appointed to Stanford, thank you. When I was appointed to Stanford, it was, I would have to say, just a wonderful job, and I'm honored. But it is still and will always be my second favorite job in the world as a poet. And the first favorite job was that 10 years ago in Dublin, the National Maternity Hospital, which I mentioned there in the beginning, had its centenary. It was a hospital established for the poor women of the city of Dublin, was its charter. It was established in 1894. And if you look carefully for it, though it doesn't advertise the fact, it is the hospital in the Oxen of the Sun chapter in James Joyce's Ulysses. But they certainly don't advertise the fact. And they asked me to be their poet in residence for the centenary. And it was a very Irish job. It had no job description of any kind. So people would come up to me all the time and say, you know, what are you doing in the National Maternity Hospital? And, you know, are you with the new babies and the new mothers? And, you know, I never went near the new babies and the new mothers because my children were born in the National Maternity Hospital, and the last thing I would have liked to see when they were born was the poet in residence. So, but the hospital did give me a room, and there were poems I wrote there, and one of the poems, which Nick kindly referred to that year, was The Pomegranate, and my own daughter, first daughter, had become a teenager. And so this poem marked the fact, also marks the fact of the wonderful myth of Ceres and Persephone, where the child is suddenly taken, kidnapped, and goes to the underworld, and her mother goes, tries to get her back, and gets her back for just the spring and the summer, and the child stays there. But the child could have come back and not stayed there for the winter and the autumn if they hadn't eaten anything, but they eat a pomegranate. Pomegranate. The only legend I have ever loved is the story of a daughter lost in hell and found and rescued there. Love and blackmail are the gist of it. Ceres and Persephone, the names. And the best thing about the legend is I can enter it anywhere and have. As a child in exile in a city of fogs and strange consonants, I read it first. And at first I was an exiled child in the crackling dusk of the underworld, the stars blighted. Later, I walked out in a summer twilight, searching for my daughter at bedtime. When she came running, I was ready to make any bargain to keep her. I carried her back past white beams and wasps and honey-scented buddleias, but I was Ceres then, and I knew winter was in store, for every leaf on every tree on that road was inescapable for each one we passed and for me. It is winter and the stars are hidden. I climb the stairs and stand where I can see my child asleep beside her teen magazines, her can of Coke, her plate of uncut fruit, the pomegranate. How did I forget it? She could have come home and been safe and ended the story and all our heartbroken searching. But she reached out a hand and plucked a pomegranate. She put out her hand and pulled down the French sand for apple and the noise of stone and the proof that even in the place of death, at the heart of legend, in the midst of rocks full of unshed tears, ready to be diamonds by the time the story was told, a child can be hungry. I could warn her, there is still a chance. The rain is cold, the road is flint-colored, the suburb has cars and cable television, the veiled stars are above ground. It is another world, but what else can a mother give her daughter but such beautiful rifts in time? If I defer the grief, I will diminish the gift. The legend will be hers as well as mine. She will enter it as I have. She will wake up. She will hold the papery, flushed skin in her hand and to her lips, and I will say nothing. I wanted to say something a little bit more about that difference between the past and history. I suppose one of the places where it became most real to me was in being the youngest child of my mother, who herself was a youngest child of five. She was the orphan left when that young woman of 31 died, the youngest child, the baby, when that young woman of 31 died in the National Maternity Hospital. My mother was a great, great friend of mine, and who is now dead, God rest her, but to whom I owe a huge amount. But there was one thing that my mother never did, and that is she never spoke about the past and never referred to it and had no interest in those conversations. And any attempt I had to introduce the past or ask her was turned down. And so when my children were little, I tried more, and I would go down. And then one evening, when I, you know, she came from the middle of the country, she came really from the country of the Boyne Valley, Drogheda, and its outlying parts, Claughead. And her people had come there, you know, but there was still no story. And then one evening, as if, you know, a curtain had left it, she told me a story from that past. And I was just enchanted by the story. And I said to her, is that true? And she said, I don't know. And so that was that. So a few months later, I went down and said to her, tell me that story again. And she had lost a lot of interest in doing so. She told me the story again. And I said to her, but is it true? And she said, does it matter? So here is the story, and I never have been able to resist the story. It's something, or the little of something I have of her family history, about her mother's history, really. It is a real Irish story. You will know what I mean when I read it. My grandmother, my mother's mother, came from a family of millers. Sometime after the famine, they all left the small fishing town of Milford in Donegal. Hard-pressed as they were, they must still have missed the idiosyncrasy of their own place, the sight of Mulroy Bay in February light, and the main street with its steep climb up the side of a hill. They moved east and south to the town of Dundalk. There the business failed, and they moved again to Leitrim, where my grandmother's father was born. And it was to him that legend clung. And the way I build that legend now is the way my mother told it to me, just out of rumor and fossil fact and half memories. My great-grandfather, as the story goes, was a small man. He was compact and saturnine in the way of many Western Irish people. If he was anything like his son, who I met for a few hours many years ago, he had eloquent and strained features, fine profile, and close-set and obstinate eyes. There was something strained and pinched about it all, which kept it well away from beauty. He grew up in Leitrim. Sometime in his early manhood, I imagine in the early 1870s, he fell in love with a local girl. I know so little about her or about him that I must become the fictional interventionist here and say she was, of course, winning and expressive and true to him, and that he loved her stubbornly. But there was an obstacle. She was a younger sister, and in the manner of fables, her older sister was plain and deserving and on no account to be slighted by having the younger girl marry first. And so it went round. The parents insisted he should offer his suit to the older sister. They might have offered him inducements, but I doubt it. The inducement could only have been local custom and iron decorum. There were no dowries. These were poor people, reduced in circumstance by a difficult century, utterly vulnerable to the sickness of a heifer or a farthing's change in the price of wheat. They would have brought to bear on him the influence of local opinion and approval. He must marry the older girl, and that was that, and he was implacable. It would be the younger one, that was all. The younger girl, of course, retained her love for him and he for her. And finally, and now the story quickens, gets unsteady, fills with unknown passages of time and event. The impasse yielded, love triumphed. The wedding day was set. I have no document or certificate. I have my grandmother's marriage certificate, but not this one. In any case, the cold signatures of the witnesses and the sacristan could do no justice to the event. The wedding day came. It seems safe to imagine a small granite church in the middle of a townland, and the weather, more than likely, grey and overcast, and perhaps the turnout a bit more than usual because of the notoriety of the whole thing, the struggle of wills, and all the gossip and curiosity incurred on that account. The bride came dressed in white and heavily veiled. The vows were taken and repeated and said by the bride and the groom. The priest pronounced them man and wife, and for one moment it must have seemed to him that some wound of ill luck and misadventure in his own life had undergone a miraculous healing, and then he lifted the veil. It was not the face he loved. Convention had prevailed. The family had smuggled in the older and plainer girl, and he was bound to her by iron convention and legality for the rest of his life. But they had 13 children. the idea that somewhere the unwritten life, that the poetry would write the unwritten life, came to seem to me at the center of anything, certainly, that I wanted to do as a poet. And that included, of course, that unwritten and utterly central life that is in the home and that is in the domestic world, and where that powerful life is so easily made little by the events of the time and the moment. And this is a poem called The Necessity for Irony. Really, I just wrote it as a warning to myself. It was my younger daughter. We would go out on Sunday afternoons. Dublin was just awash with jumbled sales and antique sales and stamps and coins and old glass and linen, and she would come with me faithfully, and then, of course, came to the age and she didn't want to come with me anymore. And this is just called The Necessity for Irony, and as I said, was a warning to myself. On Sundays, when the rain held off, after lunch or later, I would go with my 12-year-old daughter into town and put down the time at junk sales, antique fairs. There I would lean over tables absorbed by lace, wooden frames, glass. My daughter stood at the other end of the room, her flame-colored hair obvious whenever, which was not often, I turned around. I turned around, she was gone. Grown, no longer ready to come with me, whenever a dry Sunday held out its promises of small histories, endings. When I was young, I studied styles, their use and origin. which age was known for which ornament, and was always drawn to a lyric speech and a civil tone, but never thought I would have the need, as I do now, for a darker one. Spirit of irony, my caustic author of the past of memory and of its pain, which returns, hurts, stings, reproach me now, remind me that I was in those rooms with my child, with my back turned to her, searching, oh irony, for beautiful things. Thank you. And so that idea that somehow it would be possible to write a life into poetry and have the chance to put the life I lived into the poem I wrote was very important. And as I said, my mother was a very inspiring to me as a painter, which she was also as an advocate of that life. But a person who wasn't necessarily sympathetic to revisiting it. Her mother died when she was a baby, as I've said. And her father was a sea captain and drowned in the Bay of Biscay. Because of that, there was a tremendous erasure of them. No photographs of my mother as a child. And nothing left. And, you know, my mother, as I said, was very sparing with any details. She once told me, just this small detail, that wherever her father, my grandfather's ship, docked, her mother would go to meet the ship because she feared the women at the ports. So out of that silence comes something. But I also wrote this poem to try in some way to look at that part of life, which is the past, where people were complicated, three-dimensional people, and how we can enter that space sometimes and how careful we have to be, but how we long to be there with those people. This is called Lava Cameo. A lava cameo is a brooch. You often saw it. It's a Victorian brooch. Often saw it at those jumble sales of a face cut in lava, the little surrounded cameo. And, of course, a face cut in the material of destruction. Lava cameo. I like this story. My grandfather was a sea captain. My grandmother always met him when his ship docked. She feared the women at the ports. Except that it is not a story, more a rumor or a folk memory, something thrown out once in a random conversation, a hint merely. If I say wool and lace for her skirt and crepe for her blouse, in the neck of which is pinned a cameo carved out of black volcanic rock, if I make her pace the cork dock, stopping to take down her parasol, as a gust catches the silk tassels of it, then consider this. There is a way of making free with the past, a pastiche of what is real and what is not, which can only be justified if you think of it not as sculpture, but syntax. A structure extrinsic to meaning which uncovers the inner secret of it. She will die at 31 in a fever ward. He will drown 9 years later in the Bay of Biscay. They will never even be sepia, and so I put down the gangplank now between the ship and the ground. In the story, late afternoon has become evening. They kiss once, their hands touch briefly. Please, look at me, I want to say to her, show me the obduracy of an art which can arrest a profile in the flux of hell. Inscribe catastrophe. Thank you. And so I came to really this latest book, which was called Against Love Poetry, because I had in some sense wanted to come to that place, to look at those lives we live and try to write into work. But one poem in this, which is towards the end of the book, is called How We Made a New Art on Old Ground. And it for me, was a poem I felt a connection to. I went to the Boyne Valley, which was the beautiful part of the country. I happened to be there after where my mother came from. But the Boyne Valley, as I'm sure people know here, was the scene of one of the greatest and most remembered battles of Ireland, the Battle of the Boyne, still painted into the house gables in the north of Ireland, still a huge, huge source of the division of our histories, still the place where we haven't in Ireland yet been able to decide that our differences can be our strengths and not our weaknesses. And this was just the beginning of the Irish peace process, that really blessed moment which came to that country, not a moment too soon. And it was the stirrings of that conversation which led to the peace. And for me, it was just this moment of being in that valley and reflecting on that. A famous battle happened in this valley. You never understood the nature poem till now, till this moment. If these statements seem separate, unrelated, follow this silence to its edge and you will hear the history of air, the crispness of a fern or the upward cut and turn around of a field fare or thrush written on it. The other history is silent. The estuary is over there. The issue was decided here. Two kings prepared to give no quarter, then one king and one dead tradition. Now the humid dusk, the old wounds, wait for language, for a different truth. When you see the silk of the willow and the wider edge of the river turn and grow dark and then darker, then you will know that the nature poem is not the action nor its end. It is this rust on the gate beside the trees, on the cattle grid underneath our feet, on the steering wheel shaft. It is an aftermath, an overlay, and even in its own modest way, an art of peace. I try the word distance, and it fills with sycamores, a summer's worth of pollen. And as I write, valley, straw, metal, blood, oaths, armor are unwritten. Silence spreads slowly from these words to those ilex trees, half in, half out of shadows, falling on the shallow ford of the south bank beside Yellow Island, as twilight shows how this sweet corrosion begins to be complete. What we see is what the poem says, evening coming, cattle shadows, and whin bushes, and a change of weather about to change them all. What we see is how the place and the torment of the place are for this moment free of one another. But mostly, these poems were written for my husband, Kevin. And it's called Against Love Poetry because, you know, I'm now married 34 years, and most love poems are written, you know, for the first 5 days of that. And and I basically wanted to make the poem tell the story of a steadfastness, tell the story of that. And one, the opening poem has a complicated title, but it's in which Hester Bateman, 18th century English silversmith, takes an Irish commission. Hester Bateman was a great English silversmith, and in the late 18th century, she indeed had to take Irish commissions since the English had just shut down the Irish silver industry. But there you go. And one of the things that she made was marriage spoons, and there would be these small representations. In some way, I was wistful at that idea. And so this is that. Hester Bateman made a marriage spoon and then subjected it to violence. Chased, beat it, scarred it, and marked it. All in the spirit of our darkest century. Far away from grapeshot and tar camps and the hedge schools, and the music of sedition she is oblivious to. She pours out and lets cool the sweet colonial metal. Here in miniature, a man and woman emerge beside each other from the earth, from the deep mine, from the seams of rock which made inevitable her craft of hurt. They stand side by side on the handle. She writes their names in the smooth mimicry of a lake the ladle is making in a flowing script with a moon drowned in it. Art and marriage, now a made match. The silver bends and shines, and in its own mineral curve, an age-old tension inches towards the light. See how past and future and the space between the semblance of empire, the promise of nation, are vanishing in this mediation between oppression and love's remembrance. Until resistance is their only element, it is what they embody, bound now and always. History frowns on them, yet in its gaze they join their injured hands and make their vows. However, I wanted to write a poem for Kevin that would have a real piece of our real lives. And it took me a little time to think about what that would be. But this is a poem called Thank It Be Fortune. And it has that real thing for me, and I will explain why. Kevin is a huge book collector. And when we first got married, the books began to creep from room to room. And finally, they crept up the stairs and managed to end up in the shelf over our bed. And when I looked, I saw that most of the books were absolutely gruesome stories of marriage or lovers or something. Every time I seemed to look at them, I would see these titles. So somehow, the title of the poem is from Thomas Wyatt's wonderful poem, Thank It Be Fortune. It had been other times, 20 times different. So this is for that. Did we live a double life? I would have said we never envied the epic glory of the star-crossed. I would have said we learned by heart the code marriage makes of passion, duty, dailiness, routine. But after dark, when we went to bed under the bitter fire of constellations, orderly, uninterested, and cold, at least in our case, in the bookshelves just above our heads, all through the hours of darkness, men and women wept, cursed, kept, and broke faith, and killed themselves for love. Then it was dawn again. Restored to ourselves, we woke early and lay together, listening to our child crying as if to birdsong, with ice on the windowsills and the grass eking out the last crooked hour of starlight. Now, but I want to finish this reading with a poem to which I think I will always be connected. It was the poem that was part of this, and I think I thought of it as for ourselves, but not about ourselves at all. And it is a poem called Quarantine. The poem comes from the source of everything I meant about the past as against history. Had someone not written these two lines down, practically, this small note, many, many years ago, this poem wouldn't exist. And it's in a book called Mushkel Finn, written at the start of the century, a man called Antalya Pather O'Leary writing down a little note about a couple who in the famine had walked back on a bitter night from the workhouse to the cabin where they would have had whatever lives they could have had and been happy. In the morning they were found dead, but he had held her feet to his chest to try to warm them as she had died. This is Quarantine. In the worst hour of the worst season of the worst year of a whole people, a man set out from the workhouse with his wife. He was walking, they were both walking north. She was sick with famine fever and could not keep up. He lifted her and put her on his back. He walked like that, west and west and north, until at nightfall, under freezing stars, they arrived. In the morning, they were both found dead, of cold, of hunger, of the toxins of a whole history. But her feet were held against his breastbone. The last heat of his flesh was his last gift to her. Let no love poem ever come to this threshold. There is no place here for the inexact praise of the easy graces and sensuality of the body. There is only time for this merciless inventory. Their death together in the winter of 1847. Also, what they suffered, how they lived, and what there is between a man and woman, and in which darkness it can best be proved. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
That was a wonderful reading, Yvanne. And I wanted to begin where the impact of the reading finally left us with that last poem, Quarantine. It's a poem about history, obviously Irish history. It's deeply involved with the travails of a whole culture. And yet, those sufferings are filtered through the story of a particular couple. What are the ratios of the private and the public that you see as generating a political poem, but not necessarily a public poem? And I'm thinking of Quarantine as perhaps an example of the kind of political poem that you may have evolved from your work.
It's a really interesting question. I've said this often, and I hope people will forgive me for saying it again. I think the political poem is something that most poets come towards at some point. And when I was young, you know, it was much easier to have a political murder in the Irish poem than a baby. There just wasn't going to, you know, it was extremely difficult to get the baby into the poem, but somehow everything else worked in it. And I remember thinking that if it was going to be, that this would still, as you put it in your question, be a political poem, but if it was going to be hard to get the baby into it, it was going to be much harder to get the washing machine into it, you know. So it was as if these lives came to the threshold of a poem and stopped there. And for me, the political poem is always at its strongest when it has its roots in that private lived world. The Quarantine were those voiceless people in a history. They're not a history in themselves, but they hugely tell us what that history did, how it really happened. And they tell us the story, which a lot of poetry doesn't tell, which is that people are often absolutely powerless in those circumstances.
It's interesting, though, that at the same time as you raise the dead into poetry, you also allow a certain indefiniteness to them, a kind of dignity of their silenced world. So we never know exactly who these people are, a man and a woman. When you're going back into the Irish past and excavating these lost and lives, these silenced lives, what are the problems about bringing them to the light, as it were? What kind of freedoms can you take, and at what point do you say to yourself, as you do at the end of the pomegranate, I will say nothing?
Well, I think, once again, it's very important. I think that, you know, the past is a place where you can go, but you're not free. I mean, those were the lives lived by those people. But, of course, in my case, I felt that if I didn't go to the past, then history would tell me what to think. And it would tell me what kind of poem to write. And in some ways, it was very important for me to go to somewhere and say, these lives were lived in the past. The things I live were valued there. The small details, the ordinariness, the dailiness has always mattered. And if it has always mattered and it matters to me, then the life I live and that I think other people live should go into the poem. And so for me, that decision was so important that it was the overriding one. The Irish poem had been very public rather than and political. Not so much in my own generation, but in the previous generations, the public and the political had gone together. And, you know, one of the very poignant things, if you're Irish, is that, you know, in 1847, when these cataclysmic things happened on the island and people were defenseless and struggled against fever and hunger, there is no account of that. There is no documentary account of that. Nobody wrote that down. And I think it's a warning that sometimes the small detail can be missed.
One of the things about the small details in your poetry, too, is that they often pick up a moment of crisis. There's a counterpointing going on between the livedness of daily life and at the same time the revelatory moment of crisis. So that in the case of a quarantine poem, it's when he puts his, he gives his last breath, his last warmth to her, puts his feet against puts her feet against his breast. There are other times, for example, in the poem about your daughter having meningitis, when you write, "Will we ever live so intensely again?" Can you talk a bit about the ways in which crisis leads to revelation of the truly significant contours of the historical world?
It's always fascinating to think that maybe geography has something to do with it. I think it might be deceptive, but there's a very delightful opening of an essay by Yeats in which he says, you know, that the Irish live in crisis time rather than meditative time. I'm not sure, you know, if that's true. But, you know, the Irish have a very strong connection to a sort of charged lyric poem. It's what they have liked and what they've known. And, you know, I associate it with a wonderful remark, I'm sure. I've often quoted, I've always loved the remark, I once judged a competition and for the Irish Times, and the Irish Times editor, when he was introducing the winner, said, you know, we in the Irish Times think we've got to the bottom of the mystery of poetry in Ireland. We think that, you know, whereas 10% of the Irish people read poetry, 45% of them write it, you see. And I think that, you know, the truth is that, you know, that connection of the Irish to the instant, momentary, you know, electric poem is what I think of as being Irish. The Irish culture is not a European one, it's a bardic culture. And probably the roots of the Irish poem were storytelling, invective, you know. So there's a link, I think, if you're an Irish poet, to some of that.
At the same time, to be an Irish poet for you, at least at the start of your career, was an intensely problematic matter. Could you talk a bit about the poetic culture that you started to write poems inside in Ireland in the 1960s?
Well, to start with, I mean, Dublin was it isn't now, but it was then a very small city. And it was a city that had come out of this really magical incandescent moment. I mean, lightning had struck. And so the Irish had their, against all the odds in the whole of the world, the Irish had this wonderful, revealing moment of their literature. And that was still there when I was young. The writers were still there. The sense of the lightning had been struck, but it didn't take much time to see that the sense of the powerful contemporary metropolitan culture of Dublin was male. And it was male. It wasn't just male in an uncomplicated way. There was more to it than that. There was a sense that the life that fed Irish writing was a bohemian. There are certainly words I'm not mentioning here. I mean, but you know, it was a very hard charging culture in that sense, and late living, and not too many people went home at six for tea with the family in that culture. And so, I mean, you had a sense of something grouped around it. And I felt, without being able to describe it in words, increasing pressure that not only was this a very male culture, because I understood that its historical nature, but that it could be exclusionary. I married, I went to live just 3 or 4 miles outside the city center, and suddenly that world that had seemed a privileged access when I was a student was gone, and I was living in the world of small children and suburban housing, and really it was as if I had, in some fable, left the poem 3 miles back, and that the life I was going to live couldn't be put in that poem. And if I wanted to leave everything there and go back 3 miles, I could have the poem, but I couldn't bring it with me. And that of course, however dramatic and problematic it is a sense of flawed permissions. And the society was in fact issuing permissions to one person or one sort of person to be a poet and not to another. And for me, it became a very difficult unraveling of that flawed permission. And the idea that we had come so far as a people and as a country. I mean, we were the people who wrote the book on resisting colonialism. That we would colonize our own people, that we would not write 50% of the people into our literature. I mean, I didn't expect the literary culture to be logical, but I could see that, you know, if you commended the argument, you would have to see that it was against our spirit and our tradition as a writing community and as an island who had written our story to be exclusionary in that way. But that puts it into a sort of very formed paragraphs. At the time, it wasn't. It was in much more confusion and distress, and finally determination on my part to try to move beyond that.
As I hear you talking about it, as I read you describing that culture, that Irish literary history, it seems to me that you talk about it in very tactful terms sometimes, but that one could also say it was a corrupted culture. It was corrupted to the extent that a huge amount had been screened out. Great numbers of people, 50%, 51% perhaps, had been screened out of the Irish poem. And then, gradually, as you say, things begin to reform themselves. When that reconfiguration takes place, and when people begin to see the blindnesses that they weren't previously aware of, what does that do to the previous history of a literature?
Well, see,
how does it look different?
I think that's the big question, Nick. I mean, I think it's very difficult. I mean, it would be very hard to... You have to be fair, and it isn't a wish to be tactful. I think it's a wish to be fair. The Irish writers that I disagreed with on these issues were also writers against whom the censorship had operated. I mean, this was a small, powerful, inward culture. This is the culture when the apocryphal story exists, that when James Joyce published Ulysses, that one person said to the other, you know, Jimmy's written a book and we're all in it, you know, and that was, you know, that would be, you know,
turned out to be true.
It turned out to be true. But for 35 years, it was the canonical view of the book. I mean, it was a very referential culture, not known to be, to make the critiques you wanted it to make on any given day. And I do think, I'm not sure I think it was corrupted. I think that it was a very mixed thing. Many of the things you loved and valued in that culture came out of that flawed world. You know, George Moore, who is not the Irish writer always to quote, but he once said, you know, a literary revival are six people in the same city who hate each other, you know, and you know, it thankfully belongs to George Moore's time and may have been true then, but it, these small, flawed, unideal places are at one time they're privileges to live in, but at the same time, you have to contest something in them. I don't think anything that has happened that includes the work of women. I mean, what culture wants to be without the voice and vision of women in their writing? And especially Ireland, where women have the root of that story in them. But I don't think their inclusion means any dishonor for that past. And any dishonor, there were wonderful things written by Irish poets previous to that. Wonderful male poems, wonderful male poets. They're just not the only ones, that's all. And, at the time that I wanted to push that conversation, I would have said, to challenge the way a literature is configured, it isn't against the power of male writers, because I respect it. It's against their privileges. And nobody's privileges extend to excluding the future world of their daughters or their wives or their mothers or all that that has meant. And the only thing I would say, you know, is that Ireland is an abrasive culture. Everybody likes an argument. and I didn't not like the argument. I didn't always sense. I didn't want it to become what the French call a dialogue of the deaf. Mm. I didn't want that. And I hope and I think that there are, places where it has moved on. And we know much more now. And I don't mean in Irish literature. I think the terrible thing that happened to Ireland over that quarter of a century, where, as I said, our differences became our weaknesses, made it a lot of hard questions were asked. A lot of hard moments were reached. A lot of moments where people had to look at that place and say, who are we? And that this could happen. And I think those questions have led forward in many ways.
That conversation is obviously not over. It's not as if everything has been reconfigured and now we're all happy people together. But I think it would be true to say that there is now a kind of visible history for somebody like you only starting writing today, and a set of figures that poet could look back to and say, these poets provide an example for me. You could go back to very early in the century to, I don't know, a poet like Anna Akhmatova. You can go to contemporary poets like yourself, like Adrienne Rich, a poet like Elizabeth Bishop. There is a raised visibility for the woman who is a poet today, even if that inclusion has not yet been wholly consolidated. As you look at the poetic world today, where do you see the filters and the exclusions now? What is on the other side of the pale now in the poetic world, if it's not exactly the situation that you encountered?
I think the place where you and I know a lot happens is in the classroom and everything that it means. It's very often there that people get a sense of possibility and authority. And I think, that you have to know that that women can change the past of poetry as well as the present. It was very important to me to have that moment in Irish literature where we could all sit down and say, well, we know they're women writers, but they are also Irish writers. And that means that they are going to change the past as well as the future. They are going to change the inheritance. They're going to change everything that we understand by those terms. I think we have to teach people that the inclusions of the present, you know, it's not just putting a writer in a book. It means that you are free to go back and say, now I can see this in the light of that. And to know nothing is set in stone, you know. There is a difference between the canon and the tradition. And the canon is in every generation, for good and for ill, an act of power. But the tradition is the poem that is handed from person to person, that is loved and recited and remembered. And the poem of the tradition is the one that survives. And it is always the poem that is loved and remembered. There's an Irish phrase, a poem that lives in the hearts of the people. And the poem of the tradition triumphs. Something that I thought was wrong in 30 years ago was that the poem of the tradition had to fight its survival outside the classroom and the poem of the canon. And sometimes they were one and the same, but not. The poem of the canon could be handed on, but the poem of the tradition had to creep around. Now I think the classroom is a place where we can have both, when there can be peace between them. And I think that that has changed, and I hope we'll go on to change. Mm.
Just to switch gears a little bit, since we don't have very much time left, I wanted to ask you about a couple of things that seem very prominent characteristics of your poetry. One of them is an intense engagement and interest with place. It's written throughout your work. And yet at the same time, I get the feeling that part of the intensity of your feeling for place comes from a sense of displacement. And that your early life in some ways was a history of displacements. And in your latest work too, that in a certain sense, you've become displaced from the Dublin, for example, that you grew up in the 60s. I think in the last book, you refer to it as my little earth, my city of white pepper. Mm. So it's a world now out of reach, almost. Could you talk about that?
Well, I was a child. I mean, I did it, certainly. As a child, I felt that I wasn't in my own country, even though, you know, I grew up in privileged circumstances. I wanted to be an Irish child, and I wasn't. And certainly in the places I live, I think that place is the great fiction that people bring with them. And, you know, Elizabeth Bishop in an interview said this very poignant thing, I mean, very heartbreaking thing. She said, you know, all my life I felt like a guest everywhere. Mm. And, you know, I'm not sure that we don't all in the end become exiles in our own country. Anyway, the place changes. We don't recognize it. The Dublin that Kevin and I were young in is not the Dublin our daughters are in. Place is that fictive, powerful thing you attach yourself to. But it may not be real. I should say about the city of white pepper that when I was a child, my mother used white pepper. Mm. And white pepper was a great Irish addition to Irish stew. And white pepper used liberally on Irish stew was a great memory for me of my childhood. But then black pepper came in, and I felt one of these small marginalia of lives. I felt outraged that black pepper replaced white pepper. So that, you know, I wanted to put it there.
I've noticed you don't often reach for the pepper these
days. No, I don't reach for the pepper, no.
Thinking of those grains of white pepper also makes me think of another thing that's very striking about your work, an interest in objects, a start from objects. I think one of the first poems that survives into the canon of your work, the first poem in your selected poems, is a poem about a fan. But there are many other examples, including, for example, the silver spoon. that Hester Bateman
yes.
made. Why do objects seem to release your poetic energies?
Because they have no voice. You know, they can't tell their story. And, you know, it's the fan that I had, my mother gave me. It was the first gift my father gave her. He gave it to her when he met. They met in a heat wave in Paris. And so she gave it to me, and I kept it. And one day I said to her, you know, I'm going to write a poem about that. And she said to me, be sure if you write that poem to say that that lace is Chantilly lace. I'm afraid I didn't, but you know, it was interesting to me. You know, that part of the fan had fallen away by the time it came to me. The fan can't speak. It can't say to you, I'm Chantilly Lace. It doesn't have any way. And so that voicelessness, you know, for me is very interesting.
Another way in which I think people would be interested to think about the dimensions of your work is that there's a poem in the last book called Code, which is addressed to a woman from an earlier part of the century writing computer code.
Yes.
How did that poem come about?
Well, you know, people. I love computers, and I would like to have been a programmer. And I wasn't. I was a poet, and it's extremely interesting. Nobody ever wants to meet a poet who likes computers. It doesn't fit. And I, you know, took this wonderful woman programmer and just thought of her making that code. I mean, changing the world with language. And I love the thought of that. And you know, as I said, in my next life, I'm going to be a programmer.
Well, let's not get to the next life just yet. Although I'm sure some good programs will come out of it. But I'd like to thank you for a wonderful reading and conversation.
You,
it's been really lovely.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.